Next up on This Week in Law, we've got tech and yoga lawyer Gary Kasaya, tech law professor Rob Heverly, Evan Brown, and me. We're going to discuss getting fired, getting hacked, getting sentenced, and getting a national security letter. All this and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 204, recorded March 29, 2013. Hot mess. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your direction, such as affordable business and personal documents you can trust. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code TWIL to receive $10 off at checkout. And by ShareFile, enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWIL. Namaste, everyone. Thank you for joining us for This Week in Law today. I'm Denise Howell, and we've got a fabulous panel of folks to talk about everything that's been going on in the world of technology law today. The namaste here is in honor of Gary Kasaya, who's joining us from Northern California. Gary is a technology lawyer turned yoga lawyer, but we're going, Gary, hopefully to tap into both sides of your yin and yang today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Namaste.
Good to see you. Gary's fresh back from a wonderful, wonderful trip to Costa Rica, too. I'm very jealous. Also joining us from across the country over there in Albany, New York, is Rob Heverly from Albany Law School. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Denise. Hi, Evan and Gary. It's good to be with you today.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. And yes, as Rob said, also joining us is Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois, the Info Law Group. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. I hope you're having a great Friday. It's good to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. Always. Best part of the week, as we always say, Evan.
Right on.
So let's get going with it. Although we've got some kind of heavy topics on deck for today. People getting hacked, people getting sentenced, people getting fired. Let's start out because last week, this was all kind of breaking during the show and people were saying, oh, you could do a whole TWIL on this whole PyCon thing that's unfolding. So let's start out on the social web and have a few comments about Adria Richards et al. All right. So as I said last week, I'm sure if people are not up to speed, they probably have heard about this one way or another. There was a conference called PyCon in Santa Clara, where lots of folks got together to talk about technology and programming issues. And some commentary happened in the audience that was not okay with one of the audience members. She took a picture of the folks who were speaking. They were making some comments that she found offensive. And she posted the picture to Twitter with some commentary of her own that this was not okay. Long and short of everything is that one of the people making the offensive comments was fired. And then Adria Richards, the Twitter poster, also was fired from her job. So there has been, a huge flurry of activity online and journalism around all this. I think I'm using the term journalism loosely because not all of the coverage has been great, although some of it certainly has been. One piece in particular caught my eye. Let's see, it's from a source called Color Lines, which has covered this fairly extensively, but they, as you would want to have a lawyer weigh in, I suppose, if you were going to talk about, okay, was all of this legal that happened, particularly the firings? And I think that, they're quoting Mercury News, who interviewed a lawyer. I think that this poor lawyer Therese Lawless in San Francisco cannot have had all the facts because she was pretty sure that there might be a wrongful termination case here in favor of Ms. Richards because apparently Ms. Lawless thought that there was some sort of whistleblowing going on. However, none of the people involved in this scenario worked together. They were just all at a conference with one another. Only Ms. Richards worked for SendGrid. None of the other people did. So I think it would be really difficult to say that she was fired in any kind of retaliatory way. I don't know, Evan, this one caught my eye and I just went, huh?
Right. Yeah, me too. I mean, there's a lot of facts that we don't know here because what we get is just the, you know, the prepared statements by the companies. And it's really hard to get down to any essential truth given all of the commentary on this. But, you know, based on the outside view of it here, it would seem, I certainly don't adopt the position that this this lawyer took, saying that this would be a good case for some kind of unlawful termination. It's likely that if she was an employee at all of SendGrid, I don't know if she was a W-2 employee or an independent contractor or whatever, it's likely that she was an employee at will. Most employees are. And, you know, it's perfectly fine for a company to terminate an employee like that unless there is some kind of unlawful, specifically enumerated discriminatory reason, whether that be arising under state law. This would be under Colorado law. I think SendGrid's based in Boulder. Or under federal law, you know, Title VII, whether she fell into some kind of protected class and that the firing was because of that. All of this I should have started out saying, you know, I'm not a labor and employment lawyer, so I, you know, only play one on Twill. So, you know, there's this is a charged issue because of the allegations, or at least her assertions that she was offended by these comments that she found to be sexist. So because it's charged with that sort of, with that charge, it's kind of freighted with that. I think it's easy for us, if we're lazy in our thinking, to allow ourselves to conclude that there could be some kind of sex discrimination or some kind of protected form of whistleblowing going on here. But I think if we separate the wheat from the chaff here, I don't think that that's really what's what happened here. Instead, this was SendGrid's position is that it didn't approve of the way that she conducted the reporting, quote unquote, and I'm saying that because she wasn't reporting on anything of substance, but she went to Twitter to air her grievances, and that's what formed the basis for their reason. But again, maybe they didn't even need a reason in the first place to let her go. All of this just goes back to what I said at the very beginning. There's a lot of things that we don't know about this, and so most of what I'm saying is by necessity conjecture. The bottom line is I certainly don't see any huge problem right off of the top of the pile here as to why she should be expecting to go to a federal court and get millions of dollars under Title VII or something like that.
Yeah, the big takeaway I had from this is that it's more of a social media awareness issue than a legal issue. Pretty much the way that employment law works, and again, I'm not an employment lawyer either, but it comes up so much in these social media public discussion kinds of situations, is that people are either at will employees, in which case they can be fired for any reason. You know, you don't have to have a good reason to fire them, or they are employees under some kind of employment contract, in which case they can be fired for any legally cognizable reason where there is good cause. So in either case here, I think the employers on both sides could say, you know, either we can fire you whenever we want to and you've given us excuse to, thank you so much, or we now have good cause because of the conduct you engaged in here. So I really don't think that either of the employers is in jeopardy of legal liability here, despite the fact that this was a complaint about conduct that could have been discriminatory or harassment had it been done by a coworker. We're not talking about that situation here. Have you paid attention to this, Rob? And do you have anything to add for us?
Yeah, I watched this as it started and saw the different posts going and the people talking about it. And I guess I would push back a little bit. And again, I'm also not somebody who's expert in labor relations or employment law. But what I know is that an employer, even in an at-will state, cannot simply fire somebody for a reason that violates some other substantive law. So if they come in the morning and they're wearing a blue shirt, and I don't like blue shirts, I can fire them. But if they come in the morning and they're black and I fire them, then I violated federal law. And so what we're tied into here is a whole group of regulations and statutes at federal law that deal with harassment in the workplace. I don't think she had to be in a harassing workplace necessarily for the protections of the federal law to apply to her pointing out harassment. And I think that's probably what the attorney here was talking about. It's a bit of a stretch, possibly, but we've seen some cases from the National Labor Relations Board where people speaking on Facebook to other employees and trashing the employer are found to be engaging in concerted activity. And whereas you would think that, okay, we should make concerted activity, which is typically union-type activity or activity where employees are trying to come together and do things related to their work conditions, we should do that in person or maybe in letters. NLRB is pretty happy to say, you know, Facebook works. And if you're trashing your employer on Facebook and other people are contributing to the discussion, that can be concerted activity. So I don't know that this couldn't be reporting of harassing circumstances that she was involved in because of her work and then firing her because of her simply saying that it was because it was on Twitter. We're going to fire her for that.
So let me unpack that a little more.
Yeah.
So that theory would have to go, my employer sent me to a conference and this was part of my work obligations. I had to go to this conference. It was a networking kind of function. And in the conference, my employer should have known this was a hostile environment full of harassing commentary and therefore is responsible for things said by third parties that have nothing to do with my employer. Is that how that would go?
No, I think the first part, I don't even think it needs to be mandatory. I think she just would need to be there doing work-related types of things. Mm-hmm. And then they wouldn't be held responsible for what the developer said and did, her employer. Mm-hmm. But they're not trying to discipline those employees in any way. What they're saying is when she was confronted with a situation involving harassment, and we'll accept that as harassment at this point, and she reported it, because of the method she used to report it, we're firing her. And I think that federal law says you can't fire somebody for reporting harassment, period, whether it's harassment from your own work or from someone else. Now, whether the doing it on Twitter changes the application, and I'm honestly not completely certain that that's, you know, a full, whether more would be necessary. But let's say to recover for sexual harassment in the workplace, there has to be this hostile environment, right? But if you've been subjected once to some sort of sexually harassing thing, and then you report it, that's not a hostile environment. If they fire you for the report, they violated federal law. So what I'm saying here is they're not at all responsible for the harassing situation, a hostile, potentially hostile environment at the conference. They're not responsible for any of that. But if when she complained about the harassment arising, they then fired her for that complaint, I can see the claim being potentially made there. And especially when they say it's not that she complained, she did it on Twitter. So far, I don't think the federal government is really excited about saying, oh, well, that's not the way you should have done it. So that's my point, I guess.
Okay, now I understand better, and I feel badly for trashing Therese Lawless. Perhaps she was going there, too. What do you think, Gary?
Well, I endorse pretty much the view of everything that I've heard so far. From my review of the various, I guess, traffic around this issue, it did seem to me that she actually was an independent contractor that was hired by SynGrid to basically be some sort of evangelist for them. And from what I gathered from the company's statement, their big problem was really that they felt that she was casting SynGrid in a negative light by the way that she took offense to the harassing comments and then put it on Twitter. So if she is an independent contractor, I would say that it would be highly defensible for them to terminate that independent contractor agreement, particularly if she was being hired to be an evangelist for the company, and they determined because of her response to this situation at the conference that she was casting the company in a bad light and therefore not fulfilling her contract. So there it's just termination of an independent contractor agreement. And so if she felt that that termination was wrongful, then she might have some action for breach of contract. But I think trying to extend this to some sort of harassment action based upon extending sort of the virtual office environment into a conference or something outside the confines of an office space, it is highly creative, but it strikes me as a bit of a stretch.
Right. And I think that the company SendGrid did put out a statement that's echoed exactly what you just said, Gary, that and with a slightly different gloss on it, that as an evangelist, they felt that she had now sort of undermined her ability to do her job, that her relationships with developers were going to suffer as the result of this incident. So it wasn't so much reflecting badly on the company as, you know, well, you can't really evangelize with people that now there's this animosity. Evan, any final thoughts on this?
No. I probably better keep my mouth shut because I'm always up for a good dongle joke and I'm afraid I'll make one and then get in all kinds of trouble.
Exactly. I don't even want to count how many episodes of Twill have had the word dongle in the title, but it's been a few, I think. All right. Well, as far as debunking other related kinds of issues around this, the whole complex article about the hot women in tech came out. Terrible timing, right? You know, in the midst of this SendGrid firestorm, and generated its own sort of, you know, how can we in 2013, you know, be living in a world where we have comments going on that probably shouldn't have been made in that context, and now we've got, you know, this terrible list of focusing on attributes that have nothing to do with people's accomplishments, achievements, and contributions to the world of technology. And I bring it up only to tell you guys kind of a funny anecdote, again, along the lines of, you know, what can you sue for? I think a lot of people were so upset about the article that they contemplated perhaps legal action. Most of the points I've seen on that front had to do with the fact that photographs used in the piece were not licensed or authorized in many cases, I believe. But my father actually, when he got wind of this, emailed me and said, "You've got to sue these people," because he was not very happy that I was included in that article. And I just kind of, again, my reaction was, "Huh, Dad? My dad's a lawyer. how would one sue, you know, if we're not talking about the copyright issues, how would one sue about this?" And he goes, "Well, you know, it's your reputation. They're trashing your reputation." And I said, "Okay, well, I think what they did was say, you know, I'm hot, whatever that means, and that I know a lot about intellectual property law. So in order to sue them for defamation, I would have to assert both those things were wrong," which, you know, the first one, it'd be real easy to show. The second one, if you've listened to enough Twills, probably easy to show too. So anyway, just another funny anecdote of just...
Denise?
Yes.
Truth is a defense. Therefore, you could not bring an action for being hot.
That's what I'm saying. So I would have to demonstrate that was wrong.
Oh, pshaw, right. Pshaw.
And you would lose.
Well, I don't know about that. But anyway, I just thought you guys would get a kick out of that. Let's, Evan, any thoughts on this before we move on?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you are listed among the top 40 hot women in tech, wasn't it 40 or something like that? So, I mean, I guess it would be interesting to get more of your personal reaction on that. I mean, because it is interesting, and it is, I mean, I guess my I guess my big question is, why does it upset you so much? I mean, it's almost as if the discussion from this presupposes that this is something offensive. And, you know, if it is offensive, if you are offended, you know, that is what it is. I certainly wouldn't try to talk you out of being offended, but it would be interesting to hear, you know, why it is that, that it's offensive to be mentioned in something like this and why it's not a compliment. And, you know, if I'm being completely a caveman for asking that question, so be it. I would just be interested in hearing your insight on that.
Well, I think there's something generational going on there, because I don't think I was quite as knocked over, offended by this as some of the other people who were included. I'm a little bit older, and I think that I've sort of more grown up in that environment where these sorts of things, you know, come out from time to time. And being older too, it's sort of, you know, it was borderline flattering at some level. And I was on Twit this last week, and I said, my initial reaction was kind of, you know, while I'm rolling my eyes, kind of wanted to send the guy a bottle of wine, you know, who sort of a nice thing to be included. But actually, it is symptomatic of the fact that, you know, even in 2013, when we're supposed to have across the board equality in the workplace, in the home, in society, these kinds of things crop up and just show us, you know, that that's not really the case. Although I got to say, Evan, you know, men are subjected to this kind of thing too. And so maybe it is equal opportunity to be objectified. I don't know. I'm kind of right. Rambling here, but it does, especially with its timing around the Adria Richards thing, it just was a really bad thing to happen when it did.
So, right. I think, was Rob going to say something?
Yeah, if I can jump in for a second. I think that part of it, I think the IRC's got part of it right, which is just that we're in a society where women aren't naturally valued for the contributions that they make. And so when you get some who are making really good contributions and they're substantively better than a whole bunch of other people, and then you put them on the list, it's just reminding them, don't forget. You know, it's like the thing at the, what was it, at the Oscars, where there was the whole song about women whose breasts have been shown. Right. Mm-hmm. And so some women were upset about that and some weren't. But it was kind of a dig. Hey, you're really good as an actress, but I've seen your breasts. Mm-hmm. And so I think to that extent, that's part of the reason some people got so upset. I was kind of fascinated by the copyright angle of this, actually, being the copyright nerd that I am. Jolie O'Dell had put in, you know, that's a copyrighted photo taken by this person. Please remove it. And I don't, the press doesn't have, you know, has a little bit more latitude with fair use. I don't know whether this particular publication online would be considered the press. It raises some interesting questions, I think, there about using media when you're talking about people and stuff isn't sort of like hot news. If it was hot news, I think it's easy. But this was just sort of, you know, a fluff piece that's supposed to make people click through the images and do that sort of thing. So I thought there was actually a little bit there with the copyright that got me thinking a little bit.
Kind of paradoxical to call this not hot news. But, you know, the fair use angle on this is interesting here, because one of the most important arguments that that the defendant would want to make, the publisher, the platform, and this would want to make, is that this is a transformative use. And it seems like the argument coming from the it may not be the person in the photo who's actually the copyright owner, but in as much as the argument is made that this is an offensive use, or this is something that's just not acceptable, that would actually play into the fact that it is indeed a transformative use. Because I think, Denise, the picture that of you, for example, that was featured there was from the ABA, right? So,
right.
You know, first of all, I guess the picture is about almost 10 years old, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's a very different, and by the way, you haven't aged a day. it was a very different purpose 10 years ago when it was in the ABA journal than it is to be on this here. And, you know, if you were to squawk about it and say, oh, this is just not acceptable, then that plays right into the argument that this is a transformative use and would kind of bolster a fair use argument. Does that make any sense to anyone?
Yeah,
it does. Let's make hot news our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Gary, any thoughts on this before we move on?
Sure. I had a couple of reactions. I actually took the time to look at the photographs of the hot women. And the first one looked like she was a Playboy centerfold. And I thought, oh, no, here we go. But when you got past the first one, most of them looked like that they were fairly professional photographs of women and technology. So I think you were sort of somewhat misled by the appearance of the first photograph. But what struck me about it as, well, I think that women and men both like to be told that they are attractive. I think that seems to be somewhat just, you know, innate that we all want to hear. But I think that perhaps what would be offensive is by putting that label on the list, what it really does is it devalues the intellectual achievement and accomplishments of the women and essentially elevates their bodies over their minds. And I think that perhaps might well be a source of some of the unhappiness with that article. If the title had been changed to the 40 most intellectually gifted women in technology, then I don't think we would have had this issue at all. But I think what's also interesting, you have this sort of thing. At the same time, we see really prominent, successful women starting to emerge in the world of technology in a very forceful way, such as Marissa Meyer, the new CEO of Google, and Sheryl Sandberg's new book, mm-hmm. Lean In. We see Justice Sotomayor out there with her new book. We have Hillary Clinton probably will be running for president. So at the same time, we see enormously accomplished women out in the public eye. So I hope that to the extent that these, you know, fairly anachronistic and somewhat pathetic perspectives on women are still out there, I think the good news in all of this is there are some amazing women that are doing great accomplishments and hopefully countervailing some of these old attitudes.
And at a certain layer, or at a, from a certain perspective, is there any? And I mean, I'm just saying this bluntly, and you know, kind of putting it out here for discussion. I mean, if we are going to live in a society and accept the freedoms that the First Amendment affords us, and if we're going to, you know, start from that premise, and then also assume that there is no tortious conduct that has happened here. Mm-hmm. No copyright infringement, let's say, whether it's protected by fair use or not. No defamation, no right of publicity implication here. Then is there any ground really to complain at all among the members of this top 40 list? Yeah, our sensibilities can be riled, but as much as we're going to talk about those sensibilities being offended, is there any room to say that without kind of blaspheming the First Amendment interest that the publisher of this should enjoy? Denise, you're the only one among the four of us who's on the list.
I'm still trying to unpack that question. I think that you're probably right. I think one of the things you were saying is there's probably no legal action to be brought. Are we going to be morally offended because free speech was exercised in this way? Probably not too badly. Someone over on my Google Plus page made the point that, you know, hey, you know, we're all for free speech. You can't really criticize something like this. And I said, you know, there's free speech and there's the good journalism. And, you know, I can hope for the latter. And I don't think this is it. And I promise not to be offended by anything like this if you all start doing the laundry in your households and watering the bamboo and doing, you know, all the traditional roles that the women sometimes by default fall into. We've talked about this on the show before. I think we did an episode along these themes when Mitt Romney's binder full of women were all over the internet. You know, that I think as more and more people of both genders fill those more administrative roles in people's lives, then we'll see perhaps less and less of this kind of thing. That's my hope.
Okay.
All right. So
I'm going to go do the laundry and make
yeah.
Run the vacuum. Hey, I got to go.
You know,
I do that now.
Good. Glad to hear it. All right. Let us move on to something completely different. Let's talk about Weave and his sentencing, if we can. But before we do that, I would like to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. First sponsor we're going to thank is LegalZoom. Now, if you've been waiting for the perfect time to start your dream business, that's right now, because you can incorporate a business or form an LLC at LegalZoom starting at just $99. Forming your business the right way can save you money on taxes and ensure your personal assets are legally protected. LegalZoom can also help with trademarks, copyrights, patents, NDAs, and more. If you have a family, guess what? You need to make sure they're protected too. You can protect your family and your assets with a LegalZoom will for just $69 or establish a living trust. And if you don't have a will, you leave it up to the government and courts to decide what happens with your family and assets. That's never a good thing. In the past 12 years, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom for LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more. LegalZoom's online process guides you step by step, so it's easy to use and you get total customer support. If you have questions or need advice in this process, and you may well, you can even access an extensive network of attorneys through LegalZoom's legal plans available in most states. You can search online profiles and unedited customer reviews to work with a LegalZoom plan attorney who's right for you or your business. So start your business and protect your family today at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm. You can get self-help services at your specific direction, or you can speak to a legal plan attorney to get your questions answered and get ongoing advice. To receive a special thank you for using LegalZoom through TWIT, make sure you enter the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L, in the referral box at checkout. You'll get $10 off. Thank you so much, LegalZoom, for supporting This Week in Law. All right, let's talk about Weave. First of all, we have our, I don't know if longtime listeners to the show may remember that we have a source who we call Deep Geek, who will sometimes run things by when there are highly technical issues involved in law-related stories. And this is one of those occasions. So I asked Deep Geek to tell us what happened here, the underlying complaint that Weave was sentenced for. And he had some interesting comments. I'll share a few of them with you. What basically happened here, he says, is they realized that the iPad was phoning home to Apple for routine whatever kind of things, and it was passing along its ID as part of the URL. These two guys, the defendants, and others in an IRC chat room correctly deduced that since the unique IDs were based on a pattern, they could more or less brute force the server and try and discover other IDs. In so doing, they mimicked the way the iPad connects. And here's the key point. Email addresses were apparently disclosed in the result of loading a URL with a correct UID. So this wasn't a sophisticated hack, Deep Geek says, if you could even call it a hack. Let's move on to some more of his comments. He says it was a very, very basic thing, amateur hour, no matter how skilled the two defendants may be. They had a PHP script pulling down the contents of pages and auto-generating UIDs to try. So in the true sense of the word, this wasn't a hacked so much as it was a harvest. While certainly Mr. Orenheimer no doubt has serious legal trouble, it's worth pointing out that Apple's method of designing the system pretty much left it wide open. AT&T just happened to host it. So in an ideological sense, the onus was on Apple to do a better job protecting their consumers' private information. There really is no excuse for it being set up in the way that it's described in the court documents. However, Deep Geek doesn't believe they should have known better is a tenable defense to a criminal charge such as this, even though it's a valid point. So what happened here is the other defendant struck a plea bargain with the Department of Justice. So he's not involved here. But Weave himself was sentenced to 41 months for this trivial activity that we've just gone through and described. And the concern is that this is another instance of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, allowing for a punishment that did not fit the crime. Evan, do you think that's what happened here?
This is a complex story because Weave is not nearly as sympathetic of a character as someone like Aaron Swartz was. You know, if you read the Ars Technica piece on it, it indicates, you know, it provides a link to the thread over on the, you know, that Weave did an AMA on Reddit the night before he was sentenced. And so you can get a good flavor there of what a lot of the commenters were talking about that, you know, he's been kind of a mean guy. You know, he's even accused of kind of running Kathy Sierra off the internet a few years ago, saying some pretty threatening, harassing things to her. So he's anything but a hero in the eyes of many people. And so that complicates the way I think most people think about this because, you know, sure, he in the end, there may have been some positive benefit to what he did in uncovering this vulnerability in AT&T's system. But, you know, this is kind of an issue we've talked about a lot. You know, what is the, you know, where do you define the line between white hat and black hat kind of activities when it comes to this? He did more than what he had to do to bring light to this problem. And given the fact that his history is paints him in a way that makes him anything but a golden boy when it comes to this stuff, it's kind of hard for us to think straight. At the same time, I don't think that should obscure the problems with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the ability for it to call for punishments that are disproportionate to the crime. But this would not be my favorite scenario to highlight those problems, as fair or unfair as that may be. You know, one of the fundamental things of the rules of evidence in the United States is that, you know, you don't bring in character evidence of unrelated stuff. And what I'm doing is precisely that, in saying that he's not a hero. And, you know, I'm just kind of joining in what other Redditors had said on that AMA. So that's for that reason, I think in the court of public opinion, this is not the right case to put on the banner or to light the torch for CFAA reform.
Well, the EFF is getting involved at this point and will be part of the team litigating, or maybe the primary team litigating, the appeal to the Third Circuit of the determinations that resulted in his over 3-year sentence. Gary, do you think that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act needs some attention? And do you think that there's a shot for the EFF here to undo the sentence that was handed down?
Well, the CFAA clearly needs attention because it is overbroad and vague and certainly extends draconian penalties that can be wildly disproportionate to the alleged offense. And I think the thing that is particularly disturbing is that CFAA liability can be triggered by violation of the terms of use on a given website. And we all know that the terms of use are rarely read and certainly rarely understood and can be triggered by merely accessing data on a given website. So this is really not a particularly good predicate to impose felony liability on citizens. The thing that struck me about the Weave case, And my facts may not be correct, but I understood that all he did was reveal to the media the fact that this security flaw existed. And if my understanding is true, I don't really see how that triggers the CFAA, and I don't see why he does not have a strong First Amendment defense. So I'd be interested to know what the other lawyers on the line think about my particular observation.
Well, here's some more from Deep Geek, who looked at this pretty closely for us, that there was actually, they were not just involved in reporting that there was a vulnerability, but in exploiting that vulnerability. They knowingly and deliberately harvested AT&T's servers, who hosted the iPad phone home service for UIDs and emails. They also conspired in IRC chat to extract more, and they went into some detail about leaking them and leveraging the email addresses to net a profit by sending spam. They also, the DOJ had the IRC logs because a confidential informant to the FBI monitored this IRC chat room routinely and was able to go back and find their many conversations on the breach. So hence, they were able to satisfy the unauthorized access portion of the CFAA.
Okay.
Rob, what do you think?
Well, I think there's an awful lot going on here on the back of Aaron Swartz, but we should probably read the EFF's involvement alongside their current efforts to work on reform. So on Monday, there was a House discussion draft to revise the CFAA, and in that draft, they actually strengthened the penalty. So, of course, people on the internet went ballistic and said, hey, haven't you been listening? To which the answer was apparently no. And the EFF is heavily involved in that discussion and the reform discussions about taking the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and doing something different with it. I think it's pretty clear that there was a violation here. He accessed the computer. He downloaded information from that access and then passed it on to third people. So I think that to third persons, he actually passed the data that he got, the lists of IP addresses and et cetera, onto the journalist as proof, because you have to prove that you've actually done the hack and you can't just sort of claim it, or else that's what everyone would do. So I think there's a lot of room. And the CFAA is a 1984 law. It's old. Think about 1984 and computers. Right. And they were there sort of, but that's around the time that IBM was saying that no one would need a desktop in their home. Right. And so sea change since 84, nothing on a complete level to take a look at whether the provisions make sense, how they get bent sometimes to fit. The whole thing about unauthorized access, that's the Lori Drew case with Megan Myers, right. And she was accused by the feds of violating the MySpace terms. And so that was CFAA violation. And the court said, Judge Wu said, I don't think so. I think just violating is not enough. Although I suppose if you violate the right rules, then you could. And we have some of those employer cases where an employee went beyond their authorization. But I think there was usually something more that they did there. They used a password they shouldn't have, et cetera. Wasn't something they had access to that somebody had said, don't look at that, and then they looked. So I think the CFAA is ripe for revision. There's a lot going on right now, though, on the Hill in relation to privacy and GPS tracking and Epic's involved and Center for Democratic Technologies involved, and then EFF's up there going after CFAA reform. So whether any of it will happen, I think, is a really open question.
Whenever you talk about 1984, all I can think about is Mary Lou Retton. So the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act would be the furthest thing from my mind in 1984. But
there you go.
Yes, but Mary Lou Retton wasn't tweeting about her victories at the time like she would have been today.
No.
All right. So let's see. We've been fired. We've been hacked. Let's really make our day and get a national security letter while we're at it. But wait a second, when we get one, it might be unconstitutional. So I've put this under privacy. So let's have that discussion. Privacy, because when you get a national security letter from the government, you're not only allowed not to talk about it, but you have to basically fork over whatever it is they're looking for. But last week, a federal judge in San Francisco, Susan Ilston, declared those letters unconstitutional. She has ordered those letters to stop being sent, but she's also put her own order on hold so that the Department of Justice can appeal this to the Ninth Circuit and see if the Ninth Circuit thinks she's right or not about the constitutionality. Rob, what do you think will happen here?
Well, I think it's really tough, right? Because this is the same kind of, this all flows out of Patriot Act stuff, and it's all the exact same kind of thing that happens whenever the country's under stress. And to a certain degree, courts want to push back, and then they don't. So if you look back at the Second Circuit decision that Ilston cites as she goes through, and her primary disagreement with the Second Circuit, I think, is that they were willing to reform the law and tell the FBI what they need to do, almost despite the language that's there, sort of saying, we don't like this, it has constitutional problems, but if you do this and this, even though the statute either says not to or says to do it differently, then it will be okay. And the FBI was like, okay. and supposedly has tightened what it's done, right? There's been lots of fraud with these that's been found in audits and the FBI agents who just sort of claim that they have exigent circumstances when they don't and claim that there's reasons when they don't. And they're fishing expeditions a lot of time. Whether the Ninth Circuit is going to be willing to push as hard as Ilston has, that I think is really up in the air.
Evan,
so I guess
I don't
have a strong opinion.
Yeah. Evan, what do you think about this? It's kind of out of left field that a trial court judge would just come in and say, you know, I'm putting my foot down on this federal government practice, and we're going to have to see what happens as it goes up the courts, which it's now in the process of doing.
Right.
Would you call her an activist judge?
I don't know. I would certainly want to, learn more about it and see what kind of approach she's making on it here, because I guess all I really need to say is it should come as no surprise to anyone that this is going to be coming up through the Ninth Circuit, right? So if the Supreme Court's going to hear it, big surprise that it's going to have found its way via, that circuit out there. Like I said, I haven't studied this really closely because I know this is such a nuanced issue. But one thing that I'm still a little bit puzzled on is that how this is primarily a First Amendment issue when it really does seem like it would be perhaps more like a Fourth Amendment issue when it comes to monitoring and privacy. I'm reluctant to say privacy because you're putting it under privacy, and the Fourth Amendment doesn't necessarily talk about privacy, but it's like a search and seizure type of issue to me. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm still unclear as to how these national security letters serve as a restriction on speech. And so if there's anything that I'm puzzled about, and to the extent that I do understand, I'm a little bit surprised that it has come up as a First Amendment issue rather than a Fourth Amendment issue. With that said, I would be doing everybody a disservice to try to speculate whether she's being an activist judge here. What I would go ahead and say is that this certainly is the type of issue where if a judge were to be an activist, it would be a prime subject matter to do that. So for what that's worth.
Denise.
All right, Gary.
Well, I have several reactions to this. It may be less of an indication that she's an activist judge and perhaps more of an indication as to the extent of the abuse involved in these letters. Personally, when I see the government taking the position that it can act without any kind of judicial oversight whatsoever for surveillance type purposes, I start getting really nervous about that. And what I found when I researched this is there was an anonymous telecom that EFF is representing in one of these cases, and when they got this national security letter, they decided to resist that letter, and they got sued by the government. But here's the interesting thing. The government took the position that by virtue of challenging the letter, it violates the law itself. So they basically created, I suppose, a very circular and dangerous argument that the mere challenge of a law violates the law itself. And I think the First Amendment comes in as under the line that there is a gag order associated with these letters. So if you get one of these letters, you can't even disclose that you received the letter in the first place. So all of this strikes me as a pretty aggressive assertion of governmental power. And I'm really not surprised that a federal judge decided to pull back the reins.
All right. So we will continue watching this one and see what happens as the national security letter issue wends its way through the courts, probably up to the Supreme Court, as Evan pointed out. Lots of Ninth Circuit decisions seem to get Supreme Court scrutiny. I've never seen an actual breakdown of the percentages of what circuits cases most frequently go to the Supreme Court, but the Ninth Circuit's got to be up there. They get a lot of review.
Can I make one last quick point on that note there?
Yes, please.
And that's that the Ilston talks about that this came first through the Second Circuit and through a Southern District of New York judge. So the East Coast is weighed in as well. I just think the Second Circuit, whether the government tries to play the same games with the Ninth that they played with the Second, sort of agreeing that we're going to tailor and we're going to narrow how we use these, and will you accept that? And the Second Circuit said yes. I think that's part of the question. And so a revision along those lines is not likely to yield an appeal that the Supreme Court would hear, I think, at this point. And I think it's interesting that it first went through the Southern District and went up to the Second Circuit rather than sort of going out on the left coast where people are a little bit more prone to throwing around words of activism.
All right. Well, speaking of First Amendment kinds of considerations, I think we're going to discuss this next week as well, since we are going to have the pleasure of having one of Evan's colleagues on with us, Jamie Rubin, who has written about this pretty extensively over on the Info Law Group site. But I did want to just touch on the fact so that people are aware that the FTC has tightened its online disclosure requirements. You'll recall, wasn't it, was it 2010 or 2011 this first went into effect? Time is compressing for me. In one of those years, the FTC instituted some requirements on people using online media, not traditional journalists per se, but bloggers, people using Twitter and Facebook, etc. We were joking before the show because Rob was holding up a cup and then had to cover the front of the cup because he was laughing that he might be violating the disclosure guidelines if there was a logo on there for the show. So, Rob, why don't you summarize for us what we must now be cognizant of under the new guidelines?
I think sort of one of the biggest pieces is just back when they originally did this, they thought it was important to mention that writing doesn't just mean paper. And if you're online, all of the national rules and regulations relating to advertising, disclosing sponsorship, those sorts of things apply. And so they've narrowed that a little bit here. And if you go to some of the links that are up on the Delicious page, it's interesting to see how the FCC's tried to use like little tweets and stuff. And examples of saying, if you're tweeting about something that's been sponsored, it has to be in that tweet. It can't be in a follow-up tweet. It can't be on your webpage saying that all of my tweets are sponsored by this. And it needs to be contemporaneous with the actual thing that's been sponsored. And I found that pretty interesting. And then you think about Twitter's method of working, 140 characters, and now you need to find a way to say in there that this thing has been sponsored, that I'm doing some, might put ad at the beginning or sponsored, lose a few characters and those sorts of things. So I think that it's just a reaffirmance by the FTC, the rules that relate to advertising apply no matter what the media, no matter what you're doing, no matter where you're putting your message out there, if it's sponsored, it has to be clear that it's sponsored and it needs to be very clear that it's sponsored. It can't be sort of around the back clear in the web, you know, web comments or when you click on a I understand link or something like that. It has to be with the statement that's sponsored. And so that's the thing that I think I would pay the most attention to. You can't get away with general disclaimers and then try to hold the FTC to saying, hey, I disclosed over there around the corner. And so I don't need to disclose on this particular whatever it is that I'm trying to show is sponsored.
Rob, has the FTC given guidelines of how they would like people to use that tiny little bit of real estate in their tweets?
Yeah, they actually have pictures like of tweets that they show as model tweets that you can look at and see how you might make it clear that this is a sponsored tweet, for example, and sorts of things with blogs and others. They have examples that you can look at and see if I've got a blog where I do sponsored content or where I mix. That's one of the sort of bigger dangers is where you mix sponsored with unsponsored content. It needs to be pretty clear. I mean, we can look at the what was the online magazine that had the Scientologist sponsored whole page ad and everybody had a fit at them and they had to, it might have been Slate. Was it Slate or that had a, I take it you guys haven't heard anything about this. I'll have to try
to
send the link. Yeah, there was a one of those sort of reputable online magazines that's well known. I don't want to defame anybody yet. So I'll look it up when I get done speaking here in a minute. And they have sponsored content and it really just looked like a story. And somewhere it might have said sponsored content, but it wasn't necessarily clear. And the sponsored content was a Scientology story about how many successes that they'd had this year. Scientology, the Church of Scientology had this year. And it just looked like a regular article from this reputable online magazine.
It was the Atlantic.
It was the Atlantic. There you go. So, and don't, I'm not making huge judgments about reputable, not, or other things, but just it's well known, and they're known for doing actual serious journalism. And it exploded around them when they had this content and they had to pull it down, and then they had to promise to look more closely at how they were doing it. This is the kind of thing that when you mix the paid content with the non-paid content, I think the FTC is pretty concerned about making sure that the paid content, the sponsored content, is very clearly marked.
All right. So there is this PDF document over at the FTC.gov site that is its .com disclosure guidelines. And if you go all the way to the end of it, they've got a bunch of examples, including tweets where they have someone saying, for example, I am a paid spokesperson for Fataway pills, typical weight loss, 1 pound per week. So you've got, you know, the paid spokesperson thing in there. I think they probably would not. How do you think they would react to Rob, somebody just putting in a hashtag that says sponsored?
I think right now, unless that developed as something that was sort of an industry kind of standard that most people understood, I don't think they'd take it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so good information here. Gary, any thoughts about this?
Just very briefly, I suppose. I think this presents a real challenge to the blogging community, as well as the community that relies upon affiliate commissions for their income, because these disclosure requirements, you know, extend to reviews and to the receipt of affiliate commissions. So this will drive a lot of new disclosure requirements through a huge segment of the web community. And from my observation, there wasn't very good compliance with the early iteration of these disclosure requirements. And these are much, much more granular, much more specific, and more difficult to comply with. So I think it will require a huge amount of education across the whole internet community that these disclosure requirements actually exist, and also how to comply with them.
All right, well, we're going to do our part here on Twill because, as I said, next week we're going to talk about this too, more with Evan's colleague, Jamie Rubin. Evan, anything you want to add to this before we postpone till next week?
I'm surprised there's not more outrage about how the government is so up in everybody's business over this. I mean, this is from a certain perspective, pretty silly that the government really is insulting your intelligence so much that it has to handhold so granularly the publishers, you know, the way the publishers are putting up content here. So, oh my gosh, we don't want anybody to be confused. So do all these little things and, you know, go through all these efforts to be compliant. This, you know, it's really bringing out my libertarian sensibilities. Maybe I should have done more to support Ron Paul and, you know, I should watch more Fox News. So it just seems like a little bit, I'm surprised that people aren't calling out the FTC for, you know, all kinds of Fox News-isms. No, this is nanny state stuff. Come on, you know, let's let people think for themselves when they're looking at content on the internet.
Right. Well, as Gary points out, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry for jumping in there. I just have a quick correction. The sponsored is actually the one that the FTC said would work.
Really?
They don't want it shortened to spawn, and they don't mm-hmm. want it changed, and they want to watch links. But if you put the hashtag sponsored, they said that would be good.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
good to know.
So they sort of established their own rule there. That's enough, I guess.
We'll go through and synthesize these examples at the back in more detail for next week's show and try and give you some takeaways for things that will work and things that won't work so well. But as Gary says, you know, a lot of people don't listen to this show, won't have the benefit of our having synthesized this 20-something page document for them. And so we'll just go forth and do whatever it is they want to do in the way they've been doing it all along. So Rob, remind folks, you know, if they do run afoul of these guidelines, which it seems like it would be pretty easy to do, what is the potential blowback for them?
Well, the FTC can come in and seek fines against them, and they can either issue fines, and then if you want to fight with them about those fines, then you end up in court fighting with them about whether or not what you've done meets the requirements, doesn't meet the requirements, and whether the fines are appropriate or not.
Right. So, Evan, here you go. Another Fox Newsism. It's just another tax.
Yep. Well, it really is. You know, it is. It just makes it more expensive for people to publish content online. You know, either, you know, hire expensive lawyers or run the risk of having the FTC knocking at your door. So it's just, you know, this seems kind of anti-business to me.
And, you know, the other aspect of this, too, is whenever the FTC brings these unfair and deceptive practices, cases against companies, they tend to be really high profile. So then the company gets a lot of really negative publicity along the lines that their business practices are unfair and deceptive. So it can be devastating from that point of view as well.
All right. Well, as I just mentioned a moment ago, it is tax time. And that's a really, really good time to start using, speaking of a sponsored portion of the show here, using one of our sponsors, and that is ShareFile by Citrix. Because, of course, during tax time, you are having to both communicate with the government, and unfortunately, I don't think the government will let you file via ShareFile, maybe somewhere down the road. But you are having to communicate with your family members and your accountant, perhaps, about preparing your taxes. And goodness knows there's nothing more confidential than that kind of information, all your financial information and what you're going to put in your tax return. So, you know, I know in my case, we have to scan things, or there are other things electronically that we need to make sure that our accountant has hold of. But if we've got stacks of documents and we attach them to an email, there's no way to know whether on our accountant's end she's going to be able to open it up and work with that. Because most business emails and lots of personal emails include some form of attachment. You've got, of course, your tax documentation, spreadsheets related to how things break down, PowerPoints, contracts, all kinds of things in your daily life require that you move them around, and you need to be sure that they get there. It needs to be received. It needs to get into the right hands. You need to know that it's confidential, and you need to know that it's been read. It doesn't always happen that way, but with ShareFile, it will. Because it sends your attachments as secure links, so you can send files of almost any size with the highest degree of security and receive notifications when your files have been opened and by who. So you've got to check it out, especially at this time of the year. It's easy to use. It integrates into any business. Plus, with ShareFile, you can access files from anywhere, your laptop, your tablet, or your smartphone. So don't worry about what device you're using. It's going to work with everything. I highly recommend ShareFile. If you're not using it yet, you need to sign up for our free trial right now. No credit card is required, and there's nothing to lose. You'll see why millions of people rely on it every day. Get started today with our special 30-day free trial offer. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's ShareFile.com, and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for helping us get our taxes done and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's move on to some copyright stories.
Yeah.
And let's make SimCity our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you are interested in listening to the show for professional credit, either in the legal or perhaps another field, we have a page over on the Twit Wiki that gives you all kinds of information about that. So if you need to know the exact link, it's kind of long. You could email me. I'm Denise at twit.tv, and I'll be happy to send it to you. Otherwise, if you go to the Twit Wiki and search for MCLE, you should find it no problem. And we'll make SimCity our second phrase for this episode. And why we stick these phrases in is in case you live in a jurisdiction where you need to demonstrate that you've listened to the show. This will help you do so if you need to do that. So in talking about SimCity, the latest version of this game launched in a kind of a cataclysmic way recently. Over at TechCrunch, they had a great phrase for it that I don't have on the tip of my tongue, but I will pull it up. Something like a cavalcade of fail. And that's because, here it is. But yes, I got it right. Cavalcade of Fail, writes Daryl Etherington over at TechCrunch. And this is because the game launched in a way that it had to be online all the time. And this was chalked up as a DRM measure, that it was constantly verifying that this was an authorized version of the game. Now, SimCity's management seems to take issue with that and has said, no, 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 lots of games have you be on all online all the time. That's how you are able to play with other players. And this is a massively multiplayer online game. And that's how you organize one of these. But the coverage has all been around the DRM angle. So I'm not quite sure what to make of the executive statements on this. It could be that they were, you know, attempting to shift the game away from being an offline game into an online game and just badly implemented that plan. Rob, have you looked at this? And what do you think of Always On DRM?
Yeah, I guess I start by agreeing with you. It didn't seem like a DRM issue to me. Lots of games are played online and are just played online. And if that's the model that SimCity's going to, then they should be upfront about that. And let's just say that's what we're doing. And you don't have something that you can play on your own computer when you're not online. And that's fine. Now, it doesn't seem like they did that. But that to me isn't so much about the DRM as their failures in deciding actually who they want to be, how they want to present their company, and what products they want to put out there. So it almost seems like they wanted to get the crowd who would want to play on their own in SimCity. And they also were trying to move to a crowd that wants to play with other people in a more integrated environment that they had more control over. So is it a DRM question? I'm not fully convinced that it was really. So DRM might have been there and been part of what they were talking about, but it didn't sing DRM to me. It just sort of sang fail.
Well, over at The Escapist, they were covering, the Game Developers Conference, and specifically comments from EA Labels President Frank Gibeau, who said, DRM is a failed dead-end strategy. It's not a viable strategy for the gaming business. And he goes on to talk about how their creative folks wanted to make this an MMO, and so they needed this online all the time component. So apparently they're, you know, trying to provide an explanation that is counter to what they got tagged with in the media. And we'll just have to see, you know, how it works out for them. Evan, do you think this was just a case of not having the servers ready for the load?
Who knows? I mean, extremely complicated business decision and process for them to launch this. And I see this as nothing more than just another example. Yet again, we have these every week, it seems like, where DRM and the issue of DRM serves as a lightning rod to polarize people. Am I mixing metaphors? Because, you know, there's polarity.
Yes.
Because there is the negative and positive charges that results in light. So I think that's might be a mixed metaphor, but you can kind of jump it pretty quickly there. You know, DRM is such a polarizing issue, and it's kind of hip to jump on the anti-DRM bandwagon. And that's exactly what happened here, even though there is a perfectly plausible explanation, business decisions that could have been in play here that the EA executive's comments elucidate. And, you know, I see no reason why we shouldn't take him at his word in saying that this isn't really a DRM issue, especially given the fact that it's so easy to lampoon DRM. Because, you know, at the same time, like Rob just pointed out, there are tons of games that are played only online. So it seems a little bit disingenuous to for it to be 2013 and for everybody to either have broadband access at home or 4G access just about wherever you go to be complaining that you have to be connected to the internet. I mean, come on, it's not 1997. It's not the last year that I ever played SimCity. This is 2013. Let's get with it here.
I don't know. I was last month up in a part of Northern California where I had almost zero internet access. And I think that this kind of an issue would have really bugged me had I been wanting to play SimCity in that atmosphere. Gary, what do you think about the notion of games validating in real time? Is this really necessary?
Well, the executives at SimCity seem to think so, because they had a variety of reasons why it was necessary from the standpoint of having a more robust and vibrant gameplay experience to be talking to the servers continuously. So I think that was the thrust that they took. And I think the way I look at this, I personally don't mind DRM so much as long as it's not painful to me, and as long as sort of it's something that's in the background. But when you have these sorts of issues with SimCity, or you have physical DRM, like, you know, plug in dongles into USB ports, or it can be a real problem from a user perspective. One reaction I wanted to make was, I used to be an in-house corporate lawyer with Microsoft, mm-hmm. and we had some very complicated business discussions about using DRM. And I think part of the equation becomes finding the proper balance between the corporate interest in protecting its intellectual property versus the amount of irritation, pain, and suffering that you inflict on your customers, and potentially the loss of customers through whatever DRM mechanism that you choose to impose. And I would suggest that one of the corporate reasons for using DRM isn't so much to protect its intellectual property, but it's to lock the customers into a proprietary platform. I mean, it's fundamentally, I think, about building this walled garden and keeping the customers inside the garden. So that's another reason why corporations tend to like DRM. But it's also complicated because it varies across industries. I mean, there's different considerations between the gaming industry, the book industry, movies, music, and software. I mean, they all have different use cases and different privacy risks that the publisher of that content, you know, needs to protect against. So it can be very complicated because it breaks down across different industries. And my final observation, probably the best, or one of the best analyses I've seen on the DRM issue, is something that Cory Doctorow wrote. And he wrote it actually as a consultant to Microsoft. So it's easy to find. Just run a search, and I think you'll find that a very illuminating discussion of the whole DRM issue.
Yes, Cory has been vocal on that issue for many, many years now, and has some very smart things to say.
Yes,
Scott Michaud in IRC is bringing up the point that, Evan, you brought up on last week's show, that when you combine DRM and the DMCA, you wind up with stuff that is so locked up that it's no longer really part of our public body of work. He writes, my problem, what about 40 or 400 years from now, if the content really is considered great art? Can't break DRM, doesn't expire in the DMCA. If you even technically can, it will always be a felony, even if the content is in public domain. So we're getting into that question of whether the DMCA needs to be amended such that the anti-circumvention provisions either have more permanently established exceptions or go by the wayside, correct?
Well, I guess I got a little bit distracted when you were reading from Scott Michaud's quote there, because I'm not so sure I agree with the conclusion that it would be a violation of the DMCA anti-circumvention provisions if the work was in the public domain. I know that we have some guidance from the Seventh Circuit in a case called Chamberlain. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a case from the Sixth Circuit that had to deal with Lexmark printer cartridges that suggests to us that for there to be a liability under those anti-circumvention provisions, it has to really be protecting a work, an underlying work that is protected by copyright. So I have to admit that I didn't hear any of the rest of your questions, how you characterized after teeing it up that way, just because, you know, yes, it's a real problem. And, you know, we talked about that somewhat in depth last week of how DRM unfairly and to our detriment shrinks our collective cultural heritage, and that's a real problem. But I know that it also is part of the Copyright Act, and if there's something in the public domain, circumvention isn't that much of a problem. So I don't know. I have to punt after that point.
No, you answered me very nicely, and you helped me set up what I want to discuss next, which is there was just a hearing in Congress on March 20th about copyright reform, where Maria Palante, if I'm saying her name correctly, the Register of Copyrights, was the witness. What I haven't seen is a whole lot of good coverage of what happened at that hearing. There's some articles in Billboard and Business Week about leading up to it and the public statements that the Register of Copyrights made in anticipation of the hearing. I'm wondering, Rob, did you hear anything about the aftermath?
Well, if you look at Palente's testimony, she doesn't really say too much. You read it and she talks about it's been a long time since we've looked at it, and we have the DMCA and we have copyright. It's been since 76 and it's time to look at it because things don't keep up. I think the main thing that's starting now, and this is how it's being reported, I think this is the start of a sort of movement toward doing something new that would sort of be the next big thing since 76 and take into account things. There's some interesting, I just love the rhetoric that comes with this. I'm going to look to the side and read what she said from her testimony. To this end, I would like to state something that I hope is uncontroversial. The issues of authors are intertwined with the interests of the public. As the first beneficiaries of the copyright law, they're not a counterweight to the public interest, but instead are at the very center of the equation. So she's trying to frame this. I mean, it's going all the way back to the Statute of Anne in England. This is about the authors. And as anybody who knows anything about history knows, the Statute of Anne wasn't about the authors. So I think the rhetoric of sort of pulling the authors as the ones who we're really concerned about as we deal with copyright reform, I see that as already being a little bit rhetorical and disingenuous, maybe, because that's probably not what you're most worried about. You're most worried about the industry and the economic effects. And if the authors and the creators, by authors, I mean anybody who's a creator who would have copyright, are really the central focus, I think there would be a sea change in copyright law. And the other thing that I think is really interesting, they seem to be talking a lot both during, as I understood it, at the hearings and after, there's been a lot of talk about reform of the DMCA. A lot of the provisions that relate to that seem to be something to talk. And some people complain that there are too many notice and takedown sent and that those are being abused. On the other side, there's a claim that the process doesn't work, especially for small firms, because of the Hydra-headed monster, where as soon as you take it off one place, it appears in 10 more, and it might appear in a bunch of places that you can't even get to or find. And so it's completely ineffective that way. And so we need to change and make things more harsh. So I think there's going to be an interesting dynamic going forward as Congress gets in there and see whether we end up with something SOPA-like again or something that's a bit different from the structure of what's been proposed in the past when it's been piecemeal, if they look at the whole thing.
Gary, do you think that Congress is ultimately going to do something on the arena of reforming copyright?
I hesitate to venture any guess as to what Congress might or might not do, particularly in the current political climate. Mm-hmm. But I guess my personal worry is just that they may well strengthen the copyright laws, if they do anything at all, based upon just the sheer assertion of corporate lobby power to protect corporate interest in intellectual property.
Well, that's about as uplifting as getting hacked and getting fired and getting a national security letter.
We can be more uplifting.
Kind of morning.
Yes. At least they're talking about copyright reform. Evan, any thoughts on this?
Well, I've said this before. The places that I would like to see copyright reform happen would be in statutory damages. I think those are out of proportion to the actual harm suffered by the copyright holder. And I think the term of copyright should be revisited. That'll probably never happen. I think the damage done by the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act and the whenever that was, 10, 15 years ago, and then the Eldred case thereafter, that's probably irreparable harm done to our interests when it comes to that. So, you know, those are the things that I really do feel would be in the long term beneficial and serve more purely serve the interests that, the copyright clause in the Constitution puts forth. So, and they would also help with things like copyright trolling and also foster more innovation in software and kind of make the silliness of the copyright and software and a number of things. So there are all kinds of things that could be done. If it happens, great. But there is that concern about lobbying having an unfair influence on it. I'm not going to go so far as to say that corporate lobbying is a priori bad, because it does have its consumer benefit that does get down into the cost of goods, at the consumer layer. But anytime there's an undue influence in lobbying and the things that Lawrence Lessig is concerned about, corruption and things like that, that's something that we should be concerned about. And let's hope it doesn't happen that way.
All right. Well,
one more thing. Sorry,
yes, please.
I don't want to keep it, but
that's okay.
Actually, Evan Pawlenty argues for a change in the term by saying that perhaps what Congress might want to do is have heirs and authors, well, obviously not the authors because they have to be dead or the time isn't counting, but register after life of the author plus 50, or else it would go into the public domain. So she's actually calling for a change in term based on the idea of a registration at life of the author plus 50, which is the Byrne requirement. So she's at least making noise in that direction.
Yeah, that's a good idea, and it's almost like a compromise, isn't it? Because you're not out and out changing the term, but you're putting some kind of requirement, some affirmative action that needs to be taken so that if those rights mean a lot, you ought to do something about it, right?
Exactly.
Okay, off topic, but related, quick quiz for you all, because I had to look this up over the weekend. James Joyce's Ulysses, initially published in Paris in 1922. Public domain or not public domain? What do you think? Rob?
When was it?
1922.
In France.
Yes.
Yeah, so then you're going to make me do things like figure out whether it was registered here and whether registrations were renewed and stuff like that, right? And instead, probably what I'm going to do is turn to my computer here and I'm going to Google James Joyce Ulysses public domain, right?
I should have stipulated. No Googling allowed.
No Googling.
What do you think, Gary?
Well, I'm holding actually a facsimile of the very first edition.
There you go.
Of Ulysses, and I happen to be a huge James Joyce fan. I don't know the legal answer to that question, but I think it's treated as being in the public domain.
From the standpoint, what do you think, Devin?
Excuse me?
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, Gary.
I think if it wasn't published in the United States before 1923, it might be protected by copyright if it was published in, after, and other requirements were met, the registration requirements and stuff like that. Yes. So I don't think the publication in France is going to be relevant to our copyright term here in the U.S. under the 1909 Act. But I'm ready to be educated.
Well, Ohio State University has a good page sort of trying to unpack the various copyrights around all of Joyce's works. And they have a timetable, and the Ulysses one seems to be potentially in the public domain, but they're not ready to say absolutely it is. Project Gutenberg, however, has the entire text online, and they publish things that are in the public domain. So I think It's an interesting question. I think the answer is likely it is, but as with all things, the reason I bring it up is you would think that when you're talking about a book published in 1922, we could have some certainty, but under Eldred and everything else, we don't. It's an interesting situation that we find ourselves in. Hey, before we leave the copyright topic, Gary, you have shifted your practice away from technology law and into advising yoga studios about their various business operations and the legal concerns that they face. I'm wondering if we'd love to get your thoughts, because it's come up on the show a bunch of times, the notion of Bikram being able to copyright his series of postures and whether that comes up when you're advising folks in your practice.
Yes, well, I could certainly talk about that for a very long time, but a couple of quick observations. first of all, from the perspective of the yoga community as a whole, that position is extremely offensive because many of these postures have been part of yogic wisdom for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So any attempt to, in some way, appropriate those postures and then to try to, I guess, create some sort of private ownership interest in them and commercialize them is something that's extremely problematic from a yoga point of view. Secondly, I believe that his copyright, which he had obtained for a certain period of time, has actually been overturned. But that said, what you do see in the yoga community is that he is still quite litigious and is more than willing to file lawsuits against yoga studios that are conducting yoga classes in hot rooms and that use either his sequence of poses or even a portion of his sequence of poses. So, you know, irrespective of whether or not he has a valid legal claim along those lines, I always fairly routinely tell studios that they should not practice yoga in any way that could be viewed as infringing upon his perspective as to his own brand of yoga, because what you end up with is this huge disparity in economic power. I mean, Bikram has a very large empire. He's very wealthy. He has top flight lawyers. In fact, he used to be represented by my prior law firm, Akin Gump Strauss Hauer and Feld. And he can certainly crush, you know, 99% of the yoga studios that are out there. So as a practical matter, I advise my clients to steer very clear of Bikram style yoga.
Yeah, I have recently been going to Core Power Yoga. This is a little inside the hot room, and I apologize to folks for going down too far down the yoga rat hole here. But Core Power does hot yoga in all of its sessions, and they do, you know, a traditional kind of flow, but they also do hot yoga that looks a lot like the Bikram series. So I've always wondered what their arrangement with him is, because they're pretty big and franchised and popular. So I'm sure they're right on his radar.
Well, they may well have decided to license his series because his operation is fundamentally franchised. So they could be a licensee, or Core Power is a fairly large organization. Maybe they've decided to go ahead and practice as they wish. And then if Bikram comes knocking on their door, maybe they'll be happy to fight him off. But it's not hot room. It's hot room plus his sequence of 26 postures, which is where studios can get into trouble with Bikram.
Is he claiming copyright in the like the choreography, or would it be the arrangement and selection? What's the tangible work that for which he's claiming protection?
Yes, it is the selection of 26 postures in a certain order.
Got it.
That's the basis of his assertion of the copyright.
Yes. And as long as we've been talking about harassment on the show, I guess it just bears mentioning that Bikram's on the defendant side of the litigation equation these days because one of his former students is suing him for harassment. So that will go somewhere.
At the beginning of the show, one of the first things we did was at least implicitly established that all guys are pigs, right? So is this any surprise?
I've taken classes from Bikram before, and so I'm not going to malign him, but those around him might be inclined to say, Evan, that he might fall more into that category than many of your gender.
So, I bet he totally liked that list of the 40 hottest women in tech. I bet he was all over that.
I have no idea. It does give people covering the story the opportunity to have headlines like he finds himself in hot water, etc. All right, so let's round out this show with a little discussion of the internet's impact on law and policy. All right. So we love to find ways to talk about big legal decisions that have nothing to do with technology or law, like the gay marriage oral arguments that the Supreme Court recently heard and the Defense of Marriage Act. Am I saying, is that what DOMA stands for? This following day. And we've got it because Facebook has gone red with the red equals signs and I think probably other social media tools too. But I've really, really seen a lot of this on Facebook and particularly if you follow George Takei. It reminds me very much of the public reaction, the sort of Netroots response to SOPA and PIPA when they were pending, people making their voices heard online. Now, I'm not saying something like that could possibly sway the Supreme Court, but it is an interesting development that there is this opportunity for huge numbers of people to voice opinions on policy, important kind of events. Also on Twitter, and Rob, you were the one who pointed me toward this. A lot of people used this as an opportunity to exercise their right to vote with their feet and unfollow people who were expressing opinions that they did not agree with. So Rob, do you think that this is a new juncture that we've come to in political discourse with all of these online tools?
I don't know if I'd say that. It's different, right? So the internet community stopped a law that was directly aimed at the internet community, which would be SOPA and PIPA. And that's largely the sort of narrative that flows around that, though, of course, it's much more complicated than that. As for this, I don't know that you directly affect what the Supreme Court is doing based on whether you follow or don't follow someone. I also thought that story that I sent was a little overdone. So there was, of course, the sort of bloviating sort of stuff that if you're not in favor of marriage equality, unfollow me. And then other people saying, I've seen your stand on marriage equality. I'm going to have to unfollow you. But it could also be there's also a fair amount of people, I think, who just get tired of it. Right. So they don't necessarily disagree with the speaker, but the speaker goes on and on and on and on and on about that. And so they say, I don't need this. Oh, I got the point. We understand. And so I'm going to unfollow you at least while this particular important thing is happening. Then maybe I'll come back later. So I think there's a distinction between in two ways. One is between trying to influence the courts and influence a legislature. And I think the courts are influenced to a certain degree. There seem to be some reports that in regard to the America Cares Act that Roberts was very closely watching the press, whereas other justices don't necessarily look at what the press says at all. So there's some interest on the court, especially as to perception. And then there's, I think, a distinction between laws that are focused on technology and laws that are focused on the more general community, where those who are sort of tech speakers and tech engaged sometimes might overvalue what their portion is to the number of people who are either talking or not talking to legislators and sending letters and dealing in more traditional political ways. So I think it's an adjunct. I don't think it replaces. I don't think it necessarily, outside of tech legislation, I don't think it necessarily will have, you know, sort of an overwhelming influence on the direction of policy in the country.
Okay, I think you're probably right about that. The other thing that the various online activities around those Supreme Court oral arguments taught me is to the extent to which I'm getting my news these days only from the internet and recognizing that, you know, the things that I'm seeing, the opinion that I'm seeing is coming, you know, not from CNN and other sources anymore. And also that there are things that I'm seeing on the internet that I don't think I would have necessarily seen in one of those sources. There was a great story, I think it was on Mashable, that had all the best of the signs that were pro and con the arguments outside the Supreme Court, just highlighted in a photo gallery that really was a powerful way to show the range of public opinion there at those arguments. I also really liked, and this was Nikki Black, who's been on the show before, highlighted this. Somebody named Courtney Milan on Tumblr truncated the transcript of the oral argument in Hollingsworth versus Perry to make it understandable in a really, really funny way. I mean, it's accurate. She just basically, you know, paraphrased.
Oh, now, come on. Come on. It is not accurate at
it's
all.
It's fairly accurate. It's paraphrasing.
The FTC is going to get after you, Denise, for misrepresenting so much. It is so skewed. I mean, and I'm not trying to take a position on this, but it is so lampooning of the government or the, of the proponents to Prop 8 size. So, but anyway, go on with
all right. Now, I just, you know, it's taking what would be, you know, a 15-minute presentation before the Supreme Court and truncating it down to because California said so, for example.
Yes, and it's making the proponents of Proposition 8 look like buffoons. So there, right. Now it's
well,
accurate.
It might, it, you know, I may be showing my personal biases here, but... let us go to Gary and see if he has any thoughts on political activism online.
Relative to this particular issue?
Yes, relative to this issue and relative to just, you know, we live in a world now where if you have an opinion on an issue of national importance, you can express it in a way that's going to have, you know, in aggregate, potentially an impact on lawmakers.
Right. Well, I thought that Rob's observations were really eloquent and spot on. I would say in general, I think the effect of social media opinion on the courts is really fairly minimal as a general rule. But certainly I could see a much greater effect on corporate behavior and certainly on legislative behavior. One instance that comes to mind in sort of the corporate domain is there was a story a few months ago about a very young teenage girl who discovered that the makers of Gatorade had been putting some sort of toxic substance in Gatorade. And she set up a Facebook page and started promoting it and bringing awareness to it. And it more or less went viral. And at first, Gatorade just denied and denied. And finally, in the end, they took note and removed that ingredient from Gatorade. So it's a case where a very young girl was able to cause quite a large and powerful corporation to change its behavior. So certainly, there is the ability to affect change. And there's also many sites out there that basically aggregate good causes for good works and allow people to gain awareness and also pool their resources. And so money can be collected and aggregated and then contributed into certain organizations like NGOs to do good works that people care to support. So it has created a lot of wonderful mechanisms to bring awareness and to bring money and the ability for people to contribute to certain kinds of causes.
All right. Thank you so much. I think we will go on to our resource of the week, which is a fun one for folks who enjoy robots and law. There is a conference coming up at Stanford organized by Ryan. I always forget, Evan. Is it Ryan Kahlo? Ryan Kahlo?
Ryan Kahlo is how he identifies himself. Yes.
There we go. Yes. Well, then that would be the right way. And some other great folks. Michael Frumkin is involved. It's called We Robot Getting Down to Business. It's going to be April 8th and 9th at Stanford. If you can't go, you can, of course, follow along on Twitter. Their hashtag is WeRobot2013. And it's everything to do with robots and the law. Let me just give you some ideas here. We discuss both the best legal and policy infrastructure for the burgeoning robotics industry. We're going to look at intellectual property, tort liability, legal ethics, and privacy by design. So some great topics as our robot overlords prepare their takeover. something fun to pay attention to. And I was tipless this week, so I asked our panel before the show to think about any tips that they might want to give before we sign off today. Evan, any tip on your part, tip of the week?
Gosh, I guess the only tip that I would have had would have been to think harder when you ask for tips, because I can't think of anything.
All right.
Be careful with reply all. Yeah.
Two of us tipless. Mm-hmm. How about you, Rob? Can you save us?
Well, I don't know. Is the tip supposed to relate to the show? Because we've used all the good resources on the show.
No. It can be anything that you think is of practical use to our audience here.
then I would just caution people again to think about their passwords, because there was a recent really interesting article, and I can make sure I get it to Denise to put up, about how easy it is for somebody with minimal computer knowledge to become a cracker and to crack passwords and to then sort of get in. So if you're one of those people out there who has one password that carries from site to site, or if you have something that's sort of let me in, or 1234 or 1111, you're really asking for trouble. And you can get in a lot of trouble these days with banking online and with access to work things online. So I would, I'll send a link to the article that discusses how easy it was sort of for this person who was sophisticated, but I wouldn't call, he wasn't a hacker and didn't claim to be a hacker. And what he says is that hacking passwords or cracking passwords now is script kiddie work, which means that anybody who can download the software can, and who has a computer can do it. So think about your passwords and change them if you need to. There's lots of good stuff there out there on how to do that.
Great. And we will definitely put that in the show notes with the rest of our discussion topics for today at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/204. Gary, any tips on your end?
Sure. I think to the extent that the CFAA, the DMCA, the FBI, the FTC all create stress and nervousness on your part, practice yoga.
Absolutely. And I think at least one person in IRC, Gary, when you were coming on the show, said, you know, what a dream job path to go from a hardcore technology law practice at Akin Gump to a more philosophical yoga organized practice. So we wish you well on that. And you are an inspiration to us all.
Thank you so much.
And it's been great chatting with Gary and Rob and Evan today here on This Week in Law. Gary, is there any other, aside from your good words of wisdom, that we should cultivate our inner lives and our mind-body-spirit connection? Anything else that you want to leave our listeners with before we say goodbye today?
I think practicing yoga is the greatest bit of wisdom I can offer to anyone.
Fabulous. And you can learn lots more about that from Gary on his Twitter feed, Lila Labs, where remind me which yogic person you are compiling a bunch of quotes from.
Well, I wrote a book on Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, mm-hmm. which are sort of the foundation of yoga practice. And they were written over 2,000 years ago. And so Lila Labs is actually the publishing company that I set up to publish that book. So that might be what you're referring to.
I think
but
so.
But I also have some other Twitter feeds. Like I have the Rumi Quotes Twitter feed, which has about 112,000 followers. So it's proven to be a really successful way to put wisdom information out on the internet through Twitter. And it's remarkable to me that Rumi resonates through Twitter. So it's interesting to me.
That's wonderful. We'll check that out too. Rob, tell us more about what you're teaching these days in Albany.
Well, right now I'm still teaching property. I teach international and comparative IP law. Next Friday, actually, we're having a conference here on cybersecurity and cyber warfare and privacy with a couple of good panels with interesting people coming on. I can send a link for that as well. I'm pretty sure we live stream that. So,
perfect.
And it should be up on the web after so people can take a look and see what some of the issues are and that are going on and being watched and watching the government and then in cyber warfare and cybersecurity. So lots of good stuff going on.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure speaking with both of you. Great seeing you too, Evan.
Yes, the same. Yeah, a lot of good energy, a lot of good spiritual energy as well. You know, namaste to you all. And
yes.
I'm sure Jesus would have said the same. So for those of you who are so inclined, hope you're having a meaningful Good Friday and recognize the significance of that narrative as well. So yeah, wonderful show. Wonderful show. Lots of fun.
Thank you so much. And then next week, we've got Jamie Rubin, who's one of Evan's colleagues, and Margot Kaminsky coming on. Can you tell us a little bit about Jamie? I haven't had the pleasure yet.
Yeah, Jamie is a new colleague of mine at InfoLaw Group. His focus is very much on advertising law. Follow him on Twitter. It's @ChicagoAdLawyer. So, he wrote the blog post that goes into quite a bit of depth about the new FTCs or the revisions for the .com disclosure guidelines. And so just very smart when it comes to all things, recognizing issues with promotions, advertising, social media. So I just really am, so fortunate to have him as a colleague, and it should be a wonderful conversation next week as well about that.
Great. I'm looking forward to it. I hope everyone out there can join us when we record that show, as we do all the shows, on Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1800 UTC, at twit.tv. But if you can't, you can find the shows at twit.tv/twill. Our entire archive is there. YouTube.com/thisweekinlaw is our YouTube channel. You can find us on iTunes and however else you like to find your online video entertainment. We're going to be there for you. We're just glad you're there for us, this show and every show. We really appreciate our audience and love when you guys contribute, as with Deep Geek, who had some great analysis for us today. If you have thoughts that you want to share with us between the shows, please email Evan. He's evan@twit.tv, or me. I'm denise@twit.tv. And you can find us on Facebook and on Google Plus as well. Thank you so much for everyone for joining us today, and we will see you soon.